As I begin my sermon this evening, I want us to briefly think about fairy tale stories. And I want us to consider, first of all, how fairy tale stories oftentimes begin. So think of some fairy tales, and how do those stories usually begin, or even other children's stories, how would those stories begin? Okay, once upon a time, all right, so that's something that we're very familiar with. Once upon a time, and then the story goes on and on and on and on, and then we come to the ending. And what would the common ending of a fairy story be? And they lived happily ever after. Now, fairy tales may be fun to read, right? They're quite entertaining. They're fun. But as we all realize, fairy tale stories are not true to life, are they? They're not true to life at all. They do not accurately represent reality in any number of ways. Now, as we think about any type of story, basically, whether it's a true story or a false story, we could begin most likely with the words once upon a time. What story can't begin with once upon a time? Because really, if it's set in time, the story is going to happen once upon a time. And so that may be an unoriginal story or a story beginning, but it's a functional beginning. But as you think about what happens after that once upon a time, and then at the end of the fairy tale, they lived happily ever after, it's usually what happens in between that makes the fairy tale a fairy tale, right? So usually what is recorded, what's told in that fairy tale, it's quite exceptional, isn't it? You have fabulous details, and you have things that are out of this world. You have fantasies. You have, you know, a vivid imagination at work with that fairy tale story. What happens in those fairy tales could never happen in real life. As we think about fairy tales, though, and we think of the end of fairy tales, that ending of a fairy tale is just as exceptional as anything else. Would you agree with me? So the fairy tale ends, and they lived happily ever after. And how many true-to-life stories would end, and they lived happily ever after? So only in heaven, and I'll get to that. But as we think about stories that are coming, that are actually happening here on this earth, is there ever any happily ever afters? And there really aren't. And I guess it comes down to how you define terms, but really, it's quite unrealistic to have any story end and they lived happily ever after. So we expect the fairy tale to end that way, and that makes us feel good, right? Because we love good endings. We love happy endings. Everything turns out in the end, and it continues that way until the very end. So fairy tales end, they live happily ever after, but real stories, we can't really say any of them lived happily ever after. So there may be happiness for a time, and a lot of times, you know, a fairy tale may end, you know, you have the young man and the young lady, they get married, right, and then they live happily ever after. Well, there may be happiness for a time, but how long does it take before the happiness turns to sadness or grief, the laughing turns to tears, the good times turn to times of mourning? Yes, there are many happy times in the real world, but the happy times do not reign supreme, do they? Life is not just happy times because we don't live in a perfect world. This is a world that's cursed by sin, and there's sickness, and there's disease, and there's tragedies, and there's wars, and we could go on and on and on. And sinners make poor choices, and sinners do bad things, and in the end, everyone's story will not end with they lived happily ever after, but in the end, everyone's story will end with the words, and he died, and she died. And usually, whenever we think of he dying and she dying, that's not a happy ending, is it? Now, keep in mind, we're going to talk about heaven, and we're going to talk about the hope that believers have. We'll talk about that. But the stark reality of real-life stories is he died, and then she died, and there's tears that are shed, and there's sorrow, and there's grief. Now, there are happy times. There are many good times filled with joy, but life is not all happy times. There are many hard times. And as believers, we know that this life is not easy. We realize all too well that this world is a world cursed by sin. There is the reality of sin. There's the reality of death in this world. But there is hope in Jesus. And we know that Jesus died so that he could conquer death. He rose again. God accepted that sacrifice. And so one day, and a glorious day it will be, one day there will be no more sin and there will be no more death. One day we will experience abundant life and there will be the true life experience, and they lived happily ever after. Or we could say, and they lived with full joy and wonderful peace for all eternity. Okay, so that is the ending of the true story that is yet to be accomplished. So there will be a happily ever ending. There will be a good ending to all of this, a happy ending to all of this. But in the here and now, what story ends with they lived happily ever after? Now, we'd prefer the happily ever after ending, but we realize there are so many times when things end far differently. Now, as we think about people's life stories, many times we would prefer, if we could possibly, change the choices people make, if we could change the ending so that we could make everything happily end. But that doesn't happen, does it? We don't have that choice. We don't have that power. People make the choices that they make. We can't change those choices. Now, we know that God ultimately is in control of each and every person's story. And God's plan includes what's good and what is bad, what is happy and what is sad. Now, God is never the author of sin, but God is in control. Now, we've been studying the book of Judges for some time now. And as we've come to chapter 12 now, and as we come to chapter 12, we realize that there isn't necessarily a happy ending to the account of Jephthah either. But as we come to the earlier chapters of Judges, we do find some accounts that have at least what we would call a good ending. Maybe we could even say it's a happy ending, at least as far as much as is recorded for us. So we have the account of the judge Othniel. And at the end of the account of the judge Othniel in Judges chapter 3, we read this in verses 10 and 11. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel and went out to war. And the Lord delivered Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand. And his hand prevailed against Cushan-Rishathaim. And the land had rest 40 years. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. Well, again, you have that note of death. And so death is not a happy thing, is it? But at least there's a good ending in that there's victory over the Israelites' enemies. And then there's rest for 40 years. That's a good ending, isn't it? All in all, that would be a good ending. We have the account of Ehud, and we read this ending in verse 30 of chapter 3. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest 80 years. So here, 80 years of rest. Well, if you want a story to end well, that's a fairly good ending, isn't it? We have victory at the hands of Ehud, and then you have the rest of the land. You have the land enjoying rest and peace for 80 years. We jump ahead to chapter 5 of Judges, and we have the account of God's deliverance through Deborah and Barak. And we read these words in chapter 5 and verse 31. We have a victory song, and the victory song ends with these words, "So let all thine enemies perish, O Lord, but let them that love him be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might." And the land had rest 40 years. So 40 years rest. Again, that's a good thing. We come to the account of Gideon. We read of the land having quietness for 40 years, but then we read this in chapter 8, verses 33 through 35. And it came to pass, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel turned again and went a-whoring after Balaam and made Baal-berith their god. And the children of Israel remembered not the Lord their God, who had delivered them out of the hands of all their enemies on every side. Neither showed they kindness to the house of Zerubbabel, namely Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had showed unto Israel. Now, is that a happy ending? Not by any means. Not a happy ending by any stretch of the imagination. We read, yes, there's quietness for 40 years, but then we read that Israel went back to worshiping the false gods, and then they did not treat Zerubbabel's family kindly. Well, we jump ahead now to the account of Jephthah, and will we find a good and satisfying ending? Will we read about the land having rest? Will there be any semblance of a happy ending? Now, we've already, in our study of the life of Jephthah, we have been very saddened by the vow that Jephthah made. We are very saddened by the fulfillment of that vow. Now, the text does not come out and say so in so many words, but I believe that the text is pointing us to the very real possibility that Jephthah had embraced the pagan ways of his society, of the pagan nations around him, and he did the unthinkable in offering his daughter, his only child, as a burnt offering to the Lord. I believe that paganism had weaseled its way into Jephthah's mind and thinking. Now, the Lord never demanded such an atrocious act from Jephthah. It was abhorrent in his sight. But I think Jephthah thought that this is what was necessary. In Judges chapter 11, that's very sad that we read here as far as what Jephthah did. But now we jump ahead to chapter 12. Jephthah's story is not yet over. There's more bad news to come. Now, I invite you to turn with me to Judges chapter 12 in our Pew Bibles. It's page 292. And this is an unhappily ever after ending. And as we look at Judges chapter 12, look at verses 1 and following. But let me read for you verse 1. And the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and went northward and said unto Jephthah, wherefore passest thou over to fight against the children of Ammon, and didst not call us to go with thee? We will burn thine house upon thee with fire. We think about what just happened in chapter 11. Yes, Jephthah had the victory over the Ammonites, and that's a great thing. That should have been a very joyous celebration, a victory celebration. But yet Jephthah had made the vow that if the Lord did give him the victory, then the first one that came to meet him from his house upon his victory, that one he would give to the Lord, he would offer it as a burnt offering. And who was the first one that came to meet him from his house? It was his daughter, his only daughter. I believe that Jephthah did indeed keep that vow. So imagine how traumatic that is. And even from the text, we see how traumatic, how it affected him and how it would have affected his daughter and all of this. And so coming from that, now we read what we do in verse 1 of chapter 12. The last thing that Jephthah would have wanted to have dealt with at this point in time in his life is to deal with the Ephraimites who are now coming against him with a group of men, fighting men, and being very angry that they were not summoned to go and engage in the battle against the Ammonites. And they're telling Jephthah, because you have offended us, because you have insulted us, we are going to burn down your house upon you with fire. Now, who wants to hear that after all that has gone on before this? Now, this is somewhat reminiscent of what we saw earlier with Gideon. In a way, it's kind of like deja vu. Remember when Gideon had the victory over the Midianites? What do we read about? We read about the Ephraimites confronting Gideon. And the Ephraimites ask Gideon, or they accuse him, they say, well, why didn't you call us earlier to fight against the enemy? And in that case, Gideon was able to pacify the situation. Gideon, in essence, kind of built up the ego of the Ephraimites, and he put himself down in a lower position. So with Gideon, the Ephraimites, they had been called to cut off the enemy. They cut off the enemy. They took two of their leaders, Oreb and Zeb, and they brought the heads of these two leaders to Gideon, and then they contended with him. But here in our current case, we have the Ephraimites. They never engaged in battle with the Ammonites. The Ephraimites gathered their men together after the victory was already over, and they, with their army now, confront Jephthah, and they want to teach him a lesson. You know, how dare you not involve us in this most serious matter? How dare you leave us out of this battle against the Ammonites? How could you insult us in this way? You're going to pay for this, Jephthah. And how would he pay? Well, if we were to take the Ephraimites' words quite literally, he is going to go down with his house in fire. Okay? The Ephraimites are so mad, they're going to kill Jephthah if they can have their way, if we take them literally. Now, how does Jephthah answer? Verses 2 and 3. And Jephthah said unto them, I and my people were at great strife with the children of Ammon, and when I called you, ye delivered me not out of their hands. And when I saw that ye delivered me not, I put my life in my hands, and passed over against the children of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Wherefore then are ye come up unto me this day to fight against me? Again, we're reminded of an earlier account, this time in Jephthah's lifetime, just not too long ago from this. Now, previously, Jephthah had communicated with the king of Ammon. And Jephthah asked the king of Ammon, why have you come against me to fight in my land? And the king gave a reply, and then Jephthah put forth his defense. But this time, it's not a foreign king with his army that has invaded the land. It's the people of Ephraim, a fellow tribe of Israel, that has gathered an army together that has come against Jephthah and the Gileadites. And Ephraim took issue with Jephthah because they were not called to battle with the Ammonites. And Jephthah disagrees with them. He has a far different perspective than they do. Jephthah contends that I indeed did call you. I called you to help, and then it's only after you didn't respond that I took action, and I took matters into my own hand, and we went against the Ammonites, and the Lord delivered them into our hands. So according to Jephthah, the Ephraimites had no grounds to argue with him, no grounds to take action against him. Now, honestly speaking, we don't have our scriptural record that Jephthah appealed to the Ephraimites in order for them to help deliver them from the Ammonites. But I tend to think that Jephthah is telling the truth here, and that the Ephraimites are the one distorting the story here. But again, we don't have the record in the scripture. It's possible Jephthah is not giving an accurate record of events. But whatever the case is, Jephthah here is angered by the Ephraimites. He's angered by their words and their actions, and he is in no mood to pacify the Ephraimites as Gideon had done. Jephthah is thinking, well, Ephraim, if you love violence, that's what you're going to get. If you want a war, that's what you're going to get. And our account continues with verse 4. Then Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim, and the men of Gilead smote Ephraim, because they said, ye Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites. Maybe just a little bit of background here. So Jephthah is on the east side of the Jordan River. He's a Gileadite. Now, you remember in the parting of the promised land, and even the land that was taken to the east of Jordan, whenever Moses, first of all, and then Joshua took land. Of course, it was Moses that took the land to the east of the Jordan. And then Joshua is the one that took the promised land. And there were 2.5 tribes that wanted land on the east of Jordan and declined the promised land. And there was half the tribe of Manasseh that was left on the other side, along with Reuben, and was it Gad that's on the east side of the Jordan? And then the others are on the west side of the Jordan. And so you see what's going on here. The Ephraimites, Ephraim is a large tribe, a very powerful tribe. They're on the west side. They're on the west side of the Jordan. And then you'd have half the tribe of Manasseh on the west side. You have the other half of the tribe of Manasseh on the east side. So the Gileadites are part of that half tribe of Manasseh. You remember further back in your history, Joseph, the son of Jacob, he had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay, so we have brothers, ancestors that are brothers, and it's from those two sons that we have these tribes now. Now, what angered Jephthah so much so that he gathered together all the men of Gilead and he fought with Ephraim here? Well, it's because, as you see there in verse 4, the Ephraimites said to the Gileadites, you are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites. In essence, they are saying, we are true Israel. We are Ephraimites, we are Manassites on this side of the river, and you on the east side, you aren't part of us. You're outsiders. So Jephthah, he brings his men of Gilead together. He engages in battle the men of Ephraim, and these Ephraimites they thought so highly of themselves. They boasted, "We're going to burn your house upon you, Jephthah." In their minds, they were somebody. They were a force to be reckoned with. And they looked down on Gilead. Those Gileadites across the river, those aren't true sons of Joseph. They don't belong with Ephraim and Manasseh. And it's this derisive language that so angered Jephthah. It spurred him to engage in battle against Ephraim. And the Gileadites, led by Jephthah, these so-called fugitives, they had the upper hand. They showed them who was boss. But it doesn't end there. We read in verses 5 and 6 now. And the Gileadites took the passages of Jordan before the Ephraimites. And it was so that when those Ephraimites which were escaped said, let me go over, that the men of Gilead said unto him, art thou an Ephraimite? If he said, nay, then said they unto him, say now Shibboleth. And he said, Sibboleth. for he could not frame to pronounce it right. Then they took him and slew him at the passages of Jordan, and there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000. Now, it's quite the account here. Now, this reminds us of something that happened previously in the book of Judges, actually more than once. This is not the first time that something like this has happened. We have Ehud and his men taking the fords of Jordan, and they killed many of the Moabites. We have the Ephraimites previously taking position at the waters of Beth Barah in Jordan, and many of the Midianites are killed. So two cases where we have the fords taken, or the passage by the Jordan there, taken, and the enemies were cut off and they were killed. Now, is that a good thing? That's a good thing, I would say. You know, this is God's judgment upon the enemies of Israel. But here is Jephthah now, and the Gileadites, they take the passages of the Jordan, but they're not going to be killing a foreign enemy. They're going to be killing their own Israelite brothers. See, the Ephraimites, they crossed the Jordan River to come to Gilead. Okay, so they're across the river now. They're saying to Jephthah, we're going to burn your house over you. So Jephthah gathers his Gileadites together. He engages in battle against the Ephraimites. He has the victory. What are those remaining Ephraimites going to want to do? Run across the river, get back home. Well, what does Jephthah and his men do? And actually, it just talks about the Gileadites, although you assume that Jephthah had a say in this as well. But the Gileadites, they take the river, the ford of the river, and they have this in mind. Those Ephraimites are scared, and they want to get back home. So they're going to even lie to us if we ask them, well, who are you? What tribe are you from? Where are you going? And they're fairly certain that these Ephraimites are not going to tell them the truth. They just want to get back home to safety. So what do they say? Well, in order to cross the river, you need to say a word. And it's the Hebrew word shibboleth. And that Hebrew word means a flowing stream. The problem is, for the Ephraimites, they cannot pronounce shibboleth correctly. They have difficulty pronouncing it, or at least their dialect is developed in such a way. Instead of saying shibboleth, they say sibboleth. And so whenever there's an Ephraimite coming to cross the river, well, how do you say shibboleth? They say sibboleth. Well, what happens then? That Ephraimite is dead. He's killed. He's slaughtered. Okay? Now, in a way, this is quite an intriguing story, isn't it? We'd say this is even entertaining. Here are the Ephraimites. They've come to teach Jephthah a lesson, even to kill him if we take their words quite literally. But in the end, who is it that gets the lesson taught? It is the Ephraimites. They're the ones that are slaughtered. They will die because of their arrogancy. It's a quite entertaining story. But how does God view this? These proud Ephraimites, these ones who boasted in their strength, they were killed with the greatest of slaughter. We have 42,000 of them struck down. And in a way we might say, well, they got what they deserved. But is that what God wanted? That is the question. And we could perhaps view this as divine judgment upon the Ephraimites for their pride, for their violence-loving ways. But this is tribe against tribe. This is Israel against Israel. This is their own civil war of sorts. How would God feel? And of course, we don't have the divine commentary, but how did God feel? What was his evaluation of the house of Joseph killing one another? It's a house divided. This is the end of the narrative of the events of Jephthah's life. Is that a good ending? Can we say that they live happily ever after? It doesn't seem that way. Now, we do have the final verse of verse 7 when it comes to Jephthah. Jephthah judged Israel 6 years, then died Jephthah the Gileadite and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. So 6 years, Jephthah judged Israel. He died then. He was buried in an unspecified city in Gilead. And even that doesn't really ring a happily ever after. Jephthah didn't judge very long. You can consider how long some of the other people judged. We don't have any note of the land having rest. We wonder about those 6 remaining years of Jephthah's life. Were they any better than the other years of his life? You know, we just wonder. You hope that they were better for him, but we don't have any guarantee about that. Now, from verse 7, we come to verse 8, and we have 3 more judges, very brief accounts. Now, earlier, at the beginning of Jephthah's account, before Jephthah, we read of 2 judges named Tola and Jer. We have very short accounts of them. That's before the account of Jephthah. Now, at the end of the account of Jephthah, we have three judges, and we have a very summary statement about their lives and their judgeships. So in a sense, we have Tola and Jer, a bookend on one end of the Jephthah story. We have Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon as bookends, as a bookend on the other end of the Jephthah story. So we come to verses 8 through 10. We read about this man named Ibzan. And after him, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel, and he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, whom he sent abroad and took in 30 daughters from abroad for his sons, and he judged Israel 7 years, then died Ibzan and was buried at Bethlehem. We could talk about Bethlehem. Which Bethlehem is this? Do you realize there are two Bethlehems, at least two Bethlehems, in the country of Israel? There's the one that we are very familiar with that's located in the territory of Judah. But then there's also another Bethlehem that would be in the territory of Zebulun. Which is it? We don't know. There's no specific identifier here as to which Bethlehem it is. But we do know that Ibzan judged Israel. And like Jer before him, he had 30 sons. Now you say 30 sons, that's a lot, right? And surely with 30 sons, you have more than one wife. How many wives did Jer have? Did he have two wives? Did he have three wives? Did he have some concubines? And we don't know for sure, but more than one wife, right? It'd be quite incredible to have one wife and 30 sons. Well, for our current judge here, Ibzan, not only did he have 30 sons, but he also had 30 daughters. Definitely you're talking about more than one wife here. More than one wife. So how does that work? You know, certainly more than one wife, or you have a wife and several concubines. So what we do read of, though, here, the 30 daughters, they were sent abroad to marry, and then he took in 30 daughters from abroad for his sons. What do we learn from that? Ibzan, I think, is a man of influence, and he's taking action to probably even increase his influence, his power in Israel. I think Ibzan was a man of wealth as well. You know, you think about 30 sons, 30 daughters, you have to have some income coming in order to support that large of a family. Now, we wonder, these marriages that are arranged, are these marriages arranged with other prominent families from other tribes in Israel? Is that what Ibzan is doing? Or is Ibzan reaching outside of Israel to make marriage alliances? Which is it? We don't have the details. We do know that if Ibzan reached outside of Israel to arrange marriages, that would be directly against God's will. Because God's will was for Israel to stay true to itself, and you'd have marriages within the tribes of Israel, but not outside of Israel. And you might wonder, well, if Ibzan did this, would God ever choose him to be a judge? Well, we think about another man, a man that God chose to be king later on in Israel's history. And what did the man Solomon do? A man that was given God's wisdom. Solomon had how many wives? And how did he acquire many of those wives? With alliances with foreign kings. So if Solomon did that, can we say that Ibzan did not do that? I think it is a possibility for sure that Ibzan went outside of Israel and made these marriages. Again, we don't know for sure, but that is a possibility. What we do know is that Ibzan judged for 7 years, and then he died. He was buried in Bethlehem. So like Jephthah before him, he judged for only a relatively short period of time. Next, we read of Elon, verses 11 and 12. After him, Elon, a Zebulunite, judged Israel, and he judged Israel for 10 years. And Elon, the Zebulunite, died and was buried in Aijalon in the country of Zebulun. This is a very short notice. We read that Elon was from the tribe of Zebulun. He judged Israel for longer than Ibzan or Jephthah. He judged for 10 years. But still, if you assume that there's 10 years of rest during that 10 years of judgeship, and we can't even say that for sure, but that's still much less than the 40 years of rest that we read elsewhere, the 80 years of rest that we read in earlier places in Judges. After Elon's 10 years of judge, he died. He was buried in Aijalon in the land of Zebulun. Then we read of the next judge, Abdon, verses 13, 14, and 15. And after him, Abdon, the son of Hillel, a Pirathonite, judged Israel. And he had 40 sons and 30 nephews that rode on 70 ass colts. And he judged Israel 8 years. And Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried in Pirathon in the land of Ephraim in the mount of the Amalekites. Here we have Abdon. He's the son of a certain man named Hillel. He was a Pirathonite. We read that he had 40 sons. Again, the assumption is he has more than one wife. And then in the King James, we read that he had 30 nephews. I believe the better way to translate this is he had 30 grandsons. Well, what does this make us think? Instead of living as a judge, he's living more like a king, isn't he? Seems that way, that tendency. He is living as a judge, there's no doubt about that. But he has many wives, he has many children, and his sons and his grandsons are riding on donkey colts, a sign of power and prestige. This reminds us of Jer earlier. Jer had 30 sons that rode on 30 donkeys that each had a city. Jer, we wondered, well, is he acting more like a king than a judge? We wonder the same with Abdon. We don't know positively. We don't want to jump to unwarranted conclusions here. But we do wonder. Abdon judged Israel for 8 years, comparable to Elon before him and Ibzan. He died. He was buried in Pirathon in the country of Ephraim. We have three judges, kind of in shotgun fashion here. The overall period of time that all three judges judged is only 25 years. Not a very long time at all. Very short judgeships. We don't know really much beyond that. We don't know anything beyond this of these judges. You know, what influence did they have on the people? Was it a good influence? Was it not all that great of an influence? It does seem that with the records of these three judges that the land did have some sort of peace because they have large families. Seems like they're doing well. There's no accounts of them delivering the people. There's no account of any wars or victories. So it does seem that the land had some semblance of peace and order during this period of time of these three judges. But all of that will change with the next chapter, chapter 13. Because with chapter 13, we have the last, what we call the major judge, and I think it is the last judge recorded in the book, the man Samson. But looking back to the life of Jephthah, we feel like things should have turned out so much better for them, or they could have turned out much better for him. So things could have turned out so much better for his family, for his nation. His life did not begin well, and a lot of that was out of his control. But in between, things didn't go all that well. We have some high points. Jephthah is listed in Hebrews as a man of faith. But still, Jephthah's life did not end with a fairy tale ending. It wasn't a happily ever ending by any means. And in a way, as we read through the book of Judges, and especially as we progress more and more, we are expecting that things are not going to end happily ever after. Because there's a spiral of sin, and things just get worse and worse and worse. And just the perversity and just the depth of wickedness of Israel seems to get worse and worse and worse. Yes, God is working yet. God is using men, very flawed men many times, to deliver Israel from their enemies. But the joy of the victories that God gives is tempered very greatly by the poor choices of men, by tragic events that occur. The days of the judges, by and large, were not wonderful years for the nation. You wouldn't call them golden years by any means. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And there are some men, there are some women that stand out as truly God-fearing. We could go to another book of the Bible, a book that occurs during these days of the judges, and we see some bright points in Israel's history. We have a woman named Ruth. We have a man named Boaz. They lived during the days of the judges, so that's a bright point for us. But as we look here in the book of Judges, so many things are not going well. It's a very sad account in many cases. People making far from right choices, they're doing what is right in their own eyes, not what is right in God's eyes. But yet God, time and time again, is showing himself as faithful and true. His will is accomplished even through the things that happen, whether it's good or bad. Today, as we consider Jephthah, yes, Jephthah was in the book of Hebrews as a man of faith. So like Jephthah, in that point in time in his life where he is living in faith, we want to be following that example, living by faith. But we don't want to follow all the bad examples that Jephthah provides for us. We want to live in a way that pleases God. So we today, let's be committed to a life of holiness. No compromises. We live in a very dark world. There are sinful influences all around us. And even we have perhaps the worst influence of all coming from within us. Our sinful nature wanting to draw us away. But we want to commit ourselves to be holy, as God is holy, to love God and to love others, even as God has loved us. Yes, we realize that our lives will not turn out to be happily ever after from a human perspective, but we can have a life of trusting God and obeying God, and if we do that, we can have a life of abundant joy, even if there will be sorrow and tears and death, unless Jesus comes back first. So many things we learn from the book of Judges. As we read through Judges, in some ways maybe we're mindful of our own society, our own world, and how things are going down the tubes, right? And it discourages us, but we are thankful God is still in control, and God still has mercy, and He still delivers, and God today is still saving people. God is faithful. But as we continue on through the book of Judges, we also realize, as we've seen many times before, God chooses to use flawed people to do His will, to do even great things. We're far from perfect, but God still wants to use us. There's no excuses for sin. We want to hate sin with a strong hatred. But realize, we're not perfect, but God can still use us. So many things to learn from the book of Judges. May we continue to learn and grow in our Lord Jesus Christ. Heavenly Father, we do thank You for what You've shown us here. We are, in many ways, discouraged and saddened by Jephthah's life, the choices that he made, just the events that occurred during his lifetime. We thank You that You used him to deliver Israel, and it was a great deliverance, but we are saddened by so many other things. This was not a happily ever after ending. But we thank You that You are in control, and even today, as we think about all the hardships, the tears, the difficulties, the grief, we know that Your hand is still involved in the course of history, and we can look to You, we can trust You, and we can have joy even in the midst of sadness. So I pray that our hearts would be encouraged. I pray that we would be used of You, and that we'd be holy even as You are holy, that we'd love You and love others even as You have loved us. Again, we thank You. We pray these things in Jesus' name.